Welcome. My name's Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern. I'm so glad you're here for Tuesday evenings at the Modern. This is the first Tuesday evening for the spring 2014 season. I think most of you know this is a weekly program, so you're invited back next week. You can check the website for the schedule, and there you'll also find a little information on each of the lectures. As you know, because you're here tonight, but you can pass on to your friends and friendly acquaintances, the program is free and open to the public, so spread the word. We have a very promising season, and we're off to a great start with the artist Fred Tomaselli. Fred was here April of 2004, so 10 years ago, which I think is pretty cool, after I first encountered and was struck by his work at the Whitney Biennial that year. It is great to have the opportunity to invite him back on the occasion of the Modern's Focus, Fred Tomaselli, which is curated by our own Allison Hurst. I hope you've had an opportunity to see the signature pieces by Fred and some of the study-scaled paintings that are a little more recent and the New York Times series that he has for the exhibition. They were all beautifully chosen and placed by Allison and Fred for this special exhibition, which I want to say is made possible by the Museum's Directors Council membership group. Fred Tomaselli grew up in Southern California, where he was influenced by his surroundings, such as close proximity to Disneyland, and countercultures of the 1970s and 1980s. He received a BA in painting and drawing from the California from California State University, Fullerton, before moving to New York, where he has made his career and raised his family in Brooklyn. In 2009, the Brooklyn Museum of Art, the Aspen Museum of Art, and the Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery hosted a solo survey exhibition of Fred's work, accompanied by a beautiful catalog, which happens to be available. I think actually there are only a few copies left, so get them while they last in the Modern's bookstore. Most recently, exhibitions have included the 2013 solo exhibition, Fred Tomaselli, New York Times, at the Kanzani, is that how you say that? Do you know the Kanzani Center? You don't know. Anyway, okay, so nobody's the wiser. Kanzani Center Gallery at Columbus College of Art and Design in Ohio. And then the 2012 group exhibitions, group exhibitions include In Living Color at the Flag Foundation in New York, and Poking at Beehives, Three Painters, works by Peter Edlin, Leslie Shows, and Fred Tomaselli at the Richard Nelson Gallery of UC Davis. Fred was also one of the artists invited to create work for Prospect One in New Orleans following Katrina, and he was part of the 2005 LA MoCA exhibition Ecstasy In and About Altered States. As mentioned, Fred's work was included in 2004 Whitney Biennial, as well as the second Berlin Biennial. Represented by James Cohen Gallery in New York and White Cube in London, Fred is an artist who has committed to making work he believes in, eye-popping, beautiful, joyous work informed by literature, art history, nature, Eastern mysticism, Americana, and so on, that borrows from the 19th century transcendental notion that art can indeed transport its viewer. We are fortunate to have such work in our galleries for a time, and we appreciate the artist's willingness to return to the Modern to share his ideas and thoughts with us tonight. So please join me in welcoming Fred Tomaselli.
Hi, thanks for coming. Can everybody hear me? I guess I'm supposed to show slides. How does that work? Thanks, Terry. And thank you, Allison. I love this museum, and really happy to have my work here. So thank you for everybody who did that. So as Terry was saying, I grew up in the shadow of Disneyland, you know, sort of close enough so that like every night at 9 o'clock, the fireworks would go off and Tinkerbell would fly across the night sky. And I thought that was really normal. And it actually took me, I mean, a lot of things that I took for granted growing up out there, I found out weren't actually everybody else's experience in America. And maybe it took coming to New York to figure that out. But I wanted to start with some of the earlier works just to give you a sense of where I come from and the evolution of the work. And I guess I want to start with this work called Current Theory that I made in 1983 while I was still living in Los Angeles. And what it is a bunch of styrofoam cups that are have these little threads, little leashes that go through the centers and they're taped to the floor and they blow about in the wake of these fans on the ground. And I was like really interested at that time. I'd had my mind blown pretty severely by a James Turrell show that I happened to walk into at Ace Gallery in Venice. A bunch of my friends said, "Oh, Fred, you're an artist. Let's go in. It's an art gallery. We should go in and see it." So we went in, and it was this what appeared to be a black rectangle painted in a dimly lit wall of a gallery. And we were all laughing at it, going, "Modern art is so stupid. Look." And I was laughing too. And then I went to touch this painting, and instead of touching the wall, my hand went into limitless space. And I stopped laughing. And I went, "Oh wow!" And I guess what I saw, what I got out of that Turrell piece was, you know, what you see isn't always what you think you see. And this idea of like looking and looking again, it was like it's something that I think has really stayed with me through the rest of my, you know, until now. And now I'm not going to do it anymore. No, but anyway, but I guess I had also then been exposed to like, Eric Orr and Robert Irwin and Doug Wheeler. And so I got all the, and for me, and then I'd also gone to the Bruce Nauman retrospective at LACMA in 1974. And I was just a dumb kid. And nobody explained this as art or what it meant or anything. And when I looked at all this stuff, it looked like, well, at least in terms of Nauman, it looked like a Disneyland of the repressed. You know, and everything I was looking at, I had no relationship to it with art history. And so I had to sort of make up what it meant, which is really the way it should always be. And so anyway, I started doing these works that were sort of about kind of maybe a DIY or a garage aesthetic as applied to light and space. So so this, you know, I was thinking, you know, at the time that like of like that the, I was sort of trying to make a watery environment, trying to make something that really called out its own artificiality. And I really wanted to make works that that kind of utilized the tropes of theme parks. And I wanted to like make work that was not only escapist, but also kind of explored the mechanics of escapism. And in this case, I also wanted to make water maybe out of the flotsam and jetsam that was like bobbing around on the surface of the ocean, and maybe containers that once contained liquid and making them into liquid. So those were all the things I was thinking about at the time. And it was also calm and meditative. So anyway, I moved to New York and I'm living in Greenpoint. I moved straight to Greenpoint and then to Williamsburg, 1985. It was pretty hectic over there. It was a lot of like gunfire and, you know, a lot of crack was really popular. I was like, "Oh, what's wrong with New York? It's so messed up. What's wrong with New York?" And then I thought, well, you know, maybe it's because you just can't see the night sky. So I decided to build my own planetarium. So this is a work called Cubic Sky. And what it was I took a map of the heavens, which is circular, stretched out that circle into a square, and then chopped the square up into 30 units and then folded them up on themselves, kind of thereby containerizing the infinite. I was thought that, if, you know, and each facet of the sky was sort of like laboriously like each facet had the constellations that were on the facet, and they're still drawn on the top of the cubes. I just really wanted to get it right. And I was thinking that like looking up at the heavens was your oldest way of turning your back on the world. And I also felt like I got to be God. I got to create this sort of finite universe. Anyway, it led to a lot of things. And I guess one of the things I was thinking about was like how in art school, the idea of escapist art was the very, very worst thing that you could do. And to me, I started thinking about that, and I started questioning that whole idea, because it seemed to me like escapism was probably, not only was it the dominant sort of export commodity of our culture, but it also seemed to be really responsible for the shape we were in as a culture, and it was also very responsible for the shape I was in as a person. Ronald Reagan was president. It was like an actor portraying a president. Everybody was going for it. It was very much like being there, and I was very confused by it. So I started thinking about this idea of artists as escapism, and what does that mean? So I started making these other works. This is a work called The Sweet Aroma of Revolution. That was basically 1983, and then we went to 1985. So this is 1987. This is called The Sweet Aroma of Revolution. It's the Symbionese Liberation Army logo, the revolutionary cell that kidnapped Patty Hearst and created a media spectacle, and that were eventually incinerated by the LAPD. But what it really is a seven-headed bong. So you can smoke the painting. And I was thinking about like revolutionary politics, and I had known a few people that had been in the Weather Underground, and was very interested in this notion of utopianism, and I also started thinking about how this idea of utopianism wasn't just it wasn't just something that was affecting the culture that was bracketing my existence, say vis-a-vis the hippies or later with punk rock, but. Or with the Beats, but it was also endemic to like the history of modernism. This idea of I started thinking about like how I was inheriting like this sort of transcendentalist hippie dream that was descending into disco and cocaine, and I was thinking like that was really similar to say how like how the Russian supremacists were. Or co-opted by Stalinism, or how many of the futurists became fascists. And so this idea of curdled dreams or dead utopias was just something I was sort of grappling with. So I was sort of working with that idea simultaneously. Oh, this is a work, by the way, this is from 1988, and it's called Comforter. At the time, there were these 8-100 sex matchbook covers and get-rich-quick matchbook covers that were ubiquitous in New York. And I thought, like, there was something about, like, how they preyed on dudes, men, their sort of insecurities. And I thought, like, of this, like, lonely dude sort of slipping himself into this sleeping bag. And sort of having the sort of like electronic network of the city sort of coursing through him and energizing him with thoughts of sex and money power, so it was just it was like sort of an escape pod for this person. So I guess what was happening was I had made these works that were about entering into the using your own body to physically enter into these darkened rooms, into these other realities, into these immersive environments. And then I started alluding, I guess, to different parts of the body entering into these things. And I think what was happening was that I was morphing into a painter. But I didn't know it at the time, because I had abandoned painting because of the burden of history. I really didn't know how to make pictures. I had just stopped doing it altogether. I at that point, I was only interested in performance art and installation art and new media. So around the same time, this is around 1990 now, I started doing these neural nets, and these are mostly for my own, I don't know, for me. And this is a work called Every Band I Can Remember Seeing. I guess I made this in 1990, and I made another work right after that called Every Vertebrae in North America That's Become Extinct Since 1492, and Every Rock Band I Can Remember Seeing. I did another one with Every Drug I Can Remember Taking. And I guess I was trying to posit, like, in those works, I was sort of positing this idea of mortality and, you know, like with the vertebrae piece, with the extinctions piece, I was thinking maybe positioning my own sort of hedonism while the world around me fell apart. And it was about nature and culture, about seeing and not seeing, and about extinction. Like, all these bands are or will be extinct. And then that led to this work here, where this is a photogram that was based on, I was doing these chemical celestial portraits. And what they were based on questionnaires where I would ask the sitter for their birth date and for every drug they could remember taking. And then I would do is I'd take pills and sugar and put them on photographic paper, expose them to light, develop them in the dark room, and then relabel them. And the constellations would correspond to their an astronomical location that would correspond to their astronomical sign that would correspond to their birth date, and then I would relabel the drug. So it was like a different way of getting to the person. It was sort of a portrait about inner space and outer space. They're chemical celestial portraits. So then I found 12 of my friends, the 12 houses of the zodiac. I don't really believe in astrology, but it was just a way of like organizing information. And as you can see, it was also kind of reminiscent maybe of Cubic Sky, in that I'm chopping up the heavens, but in a different way. And I'm starting to become a person who makes pictures. But I'm still really self-conscious. I still can't figure out, you know, what I'm supposed to, you know, I'm still just figuring things out. And then I started thinking, like, about this idea of this sort of pre-modernist ideal as a painting to windows to another reality. This idea of losing yourself in the sublime or transcendent other world within a picture. And I started thinking how that really dovetailed in an uncanny kind of way, the rhetoric around that, with some of the rhetoric around psychedelic drug culture. And I started thinking about, like, this idea of pictures as transportation vehicles to take you to other dimensions. And I started, because of my working class garage style aesthetics that had been formed in Southern California, in the garages of Southern California, because of my background as a shaper of surfboards and working with fiberglass and resin, like many of the kids in my neighborhood did, it'd be interesting to see if I could inlay drugs into the work and maybe rearrange their use value. So instead of maybe traveling through the bloodstream to alter consciousness, they would travel through the eyeballs, and that they could be used over and over again. So in this case, this is a work called Big as Me. It's sort of my homage to Bruce Nauman, but it's also a spine that's as big as me, and it's made out of Tylenol and aspirin and saccharin. And because I have this background in woodworking, I inlaid those slots, put the or routed out the slots, inserted these pharmaceuticals into it, and then resined over it, you know, thereby kind of preserving this ephemeral water-soluble material. So it started out very simple, and it started out more or less as an illustration of ideas I had about work, but while not still fully committing to painting. But it was like maybe painting about painting. And I know this sounds really overly self-conscious, and I apologize for that, but that's where I was in 1990. This is part of my archive of objects. I don't really use pills in my work anymore because I felt like it was becoming expected of me. But I still have them, and I still like them, and I still love the sort of intrinsic potential power within them, this sort of chemical power within them. And I'm also somewhat in awe of them, and also sort of afraid of them, and for various reasons. So anyway, so then I made this work, 13,000. This is about 1991, and it's 13,000 aspirin inlaid into a piece of plywood and covered over with resin. And I guess what's starting to happen for me is that there's this optical. I mean, I'm riffing on Bridget Riley and op art, but I'm also the opticality and the buzz of this picture started to have like its own presence apart from the rhetoric that surrounded the object. And that, I guess, started. It let things start happening. And then I would start thinking about this idea of like, well, if I'm using all this pharmacological drugs from the drug industry, it's very corporate, these corporate circles and discs and ellipses. I want to put pot in there because I want some signifier of drug subculture because I sort of felt like it was all about the same thing. So I started growing pot and I put it into the work. This is an early work, 1992, called X Will Fade. And by the way, this work here, I knew all the leaves would shift to gold over time due to exposure to sunlight. So I painted all the leaves about the color they were, except for the X that formed. This was shot years after the piece was made. The X sort of appeared over time. So I allowed sunlight to be my studio assistant on this work. But the thing that was really cool about it for me was that it had all this, for me, conceptual ideas about the materiality that I was interested in, but it also allowed the shape of nature into my work. And that became something bigger and bigger. So pot, gardening, pot, needing pot led me to gardening, whatever. Anyway, I got a lot of nature. The nature started coming into my work. So this is my backyard. And a lot of the things I use in my work come out of that. This is some Datura. This is a pan-global hallucinogen that is completely legal, but it will bring you into the principalities of darkness, into satanic realms, and I don't recommend going there. But it's quite beautiful. George O'Keefe painted them. This is my archive. This is like, so I have this archive of, this is a leaf press at the top. I pluck, press, and then dry, and then put them in these loose leaf binders. And I have this ridiculous archive of different things. So anyway, so that led to a bunch of work. This is a work called I Could See Your Voice. And I was sort of playing around with the idea of synesthesia, this idea of like seeing color, I mean, hearing color and seeing taste, you know, this sort of conflation of the senses. But I was also kind of interested, so I was like sort of thinking about Richter scales and other ways of visually measuring out sound and the illegibility, say, of psychedelic lettering. And anyway, and then that led to this piece. I was really embarrassed about this piece, and I hid it for a long time. This is called Superplant, and this I made in 1993. The reason I call it Superplant, well, I'll show you. Let me see. There's a pointer? Oh, yeah. Okay. So it looks like a plant that I pulled up out of the ground and then flattened it out. And somebody actually even called me a liar for saying that it wasn't. And I was like, well, I made it. But this is the stems are ephedra twigs, which are the basis of ephedrine, which also can become methamphetamine or pseudoephedrine. There's some mushrooms. There's hemp leaves. There's coffee beans. There's tobacco leaves. And then these little dots are morning glory seeds, which contain an indole related to LSD. So the reason I call it superplant is if it ever existed in the world, it would rule the world. But I was, I guess the thing, and blue flowers, which I painted on there because it needed them. And I guess that, I was really afraid of its decorativeness. I thought that this, you know, I don't know, I was just really nervous about that. It was embarrassing to me. But I was also very interested at that time, and still am, looking at all these sort of rhymes in art history, sort of like seeing how, like, say, the Shaker Tree of Life, how it rhymed with, say, the Rajasthani miniature of, like, how a tree or foliage might be depicted. So I was sort of conflating the sort of Eastern and Western sort of, like, art histories to make this work on top of all the other reasons I made it. Okay, so this is my archive. This is my visual archive. I guess what happened was, This is all this sort of cutout stuff that I scan and then cut out and then put on sticky paper that I can use it in a kind of intuitive way when I'm working in the studio. And I guess once I started, so I've got leaves and I've got the pills and I've got paint. And then once I started adding in photography, I realized that it was making like the reality within my work a little bit slipperier, which I really like. What's great about having artwork here at the museum is you can actually see the things instead of me having to just tell you what it would be like. But if you look at my work, you'll see like a slight depth. You'll see things floating on top of, hovering a little bit above the other. You'll see a little bit of shadow play. And then, you know, of course, then there's the finish. None of that which really comes through in photography. But I liked the way, like, for me, I thought it was interesting to see things hovering above each other. It was slightly dislocating to the eyeball of the viewer. And I like how maybe it's sometimes a little hard to tell the difference between the real, the painterly, and the photographic. So it's just another way of just keeping reality. It's just a little bit more slippery. Oh, this is a piece called Utah Saint. It's based on Mormons. I'm not going to tell you much more about it. I'm really into Mormons. So, so this is a work called Separation. Oh, what's it called? Hybrid Event and Separate. No. It's a long title. Yeah, it's a long title. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But anyway, this work here was, I was living in upstate New York by the Esopus Creek. And it's a really buggy part of the world, and I'm working with this like pristine, you know, with this resin that's really, you know, you get one piece of dust and it screws the whole thing up, and no matter what I did, there would be bugs coming up off the creek, and they would, you know, buzz around and land in my resin, and they were driving me crazy. So I decided, if you can't beat them, join them. This is, I guess, about 1994, so I brought these at that point yellow painted canvases out into the meadow next to the studio. Aimed these giant lights at the canvases. They were laying flat on these sawhorses, and I aimed these powerful lights at the yellow canvases. And the storm of bugs that came up off the river and surrounded the lights was just unbelievable. It was just this huge storm of bugs, and when the storm of bugs reached its apex, I poured my resin out, and all the bugs started sticking and dying in random formations. A kind of a portrait, if you will, of the atmosphere at that particular moment, a sort of a collision between nature and technology. And then what I did was then I built this sort of landscape or this sort of narrative landscape around that event. In this case, instead of the bugs dying in this work, they're hatching out of this cadaverous figure and into these sort of, into these morphic shapes. Some of them are painted, some of them are paint pill leaf hybrids, photography hybrids. So it's just this sort of dissected figure hatching these critters into the air. So a little bit after that, I tried to quit smoking. And this is a work called Dermal Delivery, or How I Quit Smoking. And what it is I would wear a nicotine patch every day on my body, and then I had painted this 6.5 by 9 foot canvas, you know, flesh colored, gritted it off, and then every day I'd take my nicotine patch off and stick it onto the canvas and then freak out. And put a new one on and freak out. And then I just started painting these little grids of all these squares were of like skin tones, pieces of skin from magazines. There were Band-Aids, other transdermal drug delivery systems, and just to make a kind of a large sort of skin or pelt out of the work. So a lot of this work, as you can see, is, you know, at that particular point was still kind of these private performances that were that I was like playing out in my studio. So anyway, I started thinking like, I want people to go to these places, and I was really interested in this idea of pleasure on top of all these other ideas I was talking about. I mean, the idea that pleasure was also really looked upon as pejorative, in a pejorative way, and I really I really felt, and I still felt, I disagreed with that, you know. I want work to be smart. I want work to show me what I haven't seen before. I just love being in love, you know, with what I'm looking at. And so I thought I would take people to some of my favorite places. So I started doing, whenever I'd go on trips, I would take photographs and then Frankenstein them together and make maybe nocturnes about, and paint these nocturnes. So this is a painting I made about the Ocotillos out in Joshua Tree. So this is called Ocotillo Nocturne. And the silhouettes are the six different cactuses of that region. And I guess, you know, part of me really, really loves, you know, I would love to be a Hudson River School painter. And I really love Bierstadt and Thomas Cole, Frederick Church. But I also sort of feel like, you know, I guess I'm looking, when I look at landscape, I can't just look at, although I can love landscape and I'm really comfortable in it and I spend a lot of time in it, I also see it through a scrim of information, through like water lights and geopolitical struggles and I wanted to put something in front, so I sort of, you have to look through the scrim of information to get into this, through that scrim to the thing that you're looking at. So this led to a series of different works in that vein. I'll just show you a few here without going laboring too much over it. This is, I'll tell you this about this one. This is a work, this is all paint and, you know, this is a work called Double Landscape. The center of this tondo is a little painting I did of the Jimez Mountains the Pecos Mountains in New Mexico. And then the sort of swirly sort of patterns around it are the same topography, but as a topographical map information, where I then sort of freehand sort of built these little swirls inside the topographical information. So this is a work here. So I know some people want to know like how I make things. So I don't know if I'm going to tell you all of it, but this is the work in the main gallery, Flipper. This is it being made in my studio. I mostly work on the floor. I have to have a bridge. This is a work that's, I work kind of dirty. And this work, I'll explain this work to you in a minute. I just wanted to let you know just how it is. It starts out really dirty and very schematic, and then it turns into something else. It came out of this work called Gravity's Rainbow. This is 8 by 20 feet. And I guess the way I did it was, I just took a pull chain, you know, the kind that you would have for an overhead light, and I hooked a bunch of pull chains together to make an 18-foot pull chain, and I would just drape the pull chain from the two points along the top to form a catenary, and then I would trace the catenary. And I just kept doing that over and over again, and at some point it was collage material, either leaves or pills or photographs, and then as I built up layers, the subsequent layers were primarily made with paint. And I guess it was, in a lot of respects, very indebted, I think, to Sol LeWitt, and this idea of taking an idea and just, setting up some basic principles and letting the idea just motor its way into existence. I utilize these lines as sort of like maybe skeletons or armatures for ornament. But along the way, it's entirely done in a very free associative, very intuitive way, where I'm responding to evanescent impulses, and I don't really have a sense of how it's going to end up. And I just keep piling on imagery until it feels right, until it's done. So that in turn led to this work called Echo, Wow, and Flutter. And this is just taking Gravity's Rainbow. If you took one side of it and flopped it, took it and put it on its end and then flopped it over to make a mirror image of itself, it's the same basic principle at work. And then that in turn led to Flipper, the work that is in the gallery right now. So, and you know, there's like all these other little sub themes. You know, I was really interested, and still am interested in Black Tibetan tankas, and this idea of garlands of severed heads, and so a lot of that might have to do with these like sort of severed hands and feet that and eyeballs that are sort of swirling around in this work. So anyway, I'm just going to show you a few objects. This is called bird blast. There it is. Again, just motoring from the center. I worked on this one with a Lazy Susan, and just sort of just making the work and just start working from the center, and basically just trying to fill up as much, you know, empty space as I could, and just worked my way out until it was finished. I really miss these days, because increasingly I don't know what I'm doing anymore, and it's much harder. Being a very frugal person, I always had these voids left over in these bird books. Oh, I should tell you, I'm a birder. I'm a self-loathing birder. I don't like other birders. I guess what happened was I was on a camping trip with my brother, who's a big birder. He's in the Audubon societies and the Christmas bird count and everything. We were camping in Devil's Punch Bowl, which is the deepest fissure part of the San Andreas Fault, because we're macho. And he's like, oh, if we go hike up here, we're going to see some western tanagers and some pileated woodpeckers. And I was like, well, what do those look like? So he showed me the pictures, and they're pretty amazing looking birds. So I studied the pictures. He gave me some binoculars. I was like looking around like he was. And then I go, oh, you know, western tanager. I pointed it out, and it blew my mind. Because for me, you know, growing up, birds were like just dirt in the sky. You know, I never paid any attention to it. And then I realized I had been living in this parallel reality. There was this reality that had existed all around me, and I was never aware of it. But with enhanced optics and a little bit of knowledge, boom, there it was. And that really appealed to me, given my own, hallucinogenic predilections. And I guess that just got into my work. The history of my hobbies is really my work. I just, whatever I do, whatever I like, it gets in there. It just finds a way in. So anyway, so I have all these bird books. Eventually, it was just a question of time before we would enter into work, and that's what happened. So I have all these voids, and these birds, and I started putting these Gore-Tex and polar fleece outerwear, you know, I started dressing up my birds. And, you know, kind of maybe conflating these two ways of being outdoors, you know, the sort of, you know, we're these sort of petrochemically based people now with our outer, you know, high-tech outerwear with our binoculars and our field guides. And it's such a cultural mediation. And I thought I would try to make a work about that. But it also maybe has relationship to, like, what happened to the world where the birds had to wear these outfits. But anyway, so getting back to this idea of, like, the rubble of utopianism and me having this crisis of faith in the 70s and everything, and having gone through punk rock, which really saved my life and was very helpful to me at that time, I started thinking about this whole idea of, like, America as maybe the imposition of ideology onto nature. This idea of the New Jerusalem or the New Eden that Europeans from, you know, dark, overpopulated countries come here and try to create this New Eden. But in the process, maybe create this sort of hellish environments, not only for themselves, but for the slaves and for the Native Americans that they found. And so this is a work called New Jerusalem. And I know it looks like a nice little peaceful town, but you got, let me see here. You got the Unabomber cabin, Charlie Manson's cabin, Shaker Meeting House, they're cool. But then you got the Aryan Nations compound, the Drop City Commune, Mormon pluralist houses. You get the idea. And so anyway, it's this little town of that looks all harmonious is really a town of suspicion and hate, a lot like America. Anyway, that led to some other works that related to the same thing. And let's see, we're just going to move on here. See what kind of time. Oh, I forgot to set my watch. Yeah. Oh, well, okay, I got another 20 minutes. So here's a black Tibetan tonka. I love this thing. It's so beautiful, yet there's a bull raping a guy to death. Such a bummer for him. But you can see the garland of severed heads. And these black Tibetan tonka, Allen Ginsberg had one, and he had to keep his under a shroud because he said it was way too powerful to live with. And you know, you're supposed to, this is a yama, but you know, you're supposed to conquer your fear of mortality and by contemplating this. I guess that's one of the things that's supposed to happen. They're so incredible. Like, we've got these skulls up here. This guy's getting raped. That's terrible. There's the garland of severed heads I was talking about. There's Yama. It's so metal. You know, it's, I don't know. It just kills me. I have like three of these things. But anyway, that really definitely related to the work I was making around mid-2000s. This is a work in the show called Breathing Head. It was definitely, I think really influenced not only by Tibetan tonkas, but by, let's say, Giuseppe Arcimboldo. But it was also equally influenced by my own issues around mortality and that I was going through at that particular moment. But also I was listening a lot at that particular time to the Harry Smith folk anthology. And if any of you haven't looked into it, you should. It's the greatest thing ever made in America, four-volume set. But I was particularly interested in this one. It was the Bible of the folk music movement. It was put out in 1951. It was assembled by Harry Smith, one of the great artists of the proto-beatniks of the 20th century. But he had archived and collaged this and edited a kind of a chronology of America and all of its like weird, old, whacked out, surrealist, it's just an unbelievable document that really like sort of teeter-totters between transcendence and complete lunacy. And there's one whole section that's we have guys are throwing their daughters into wells, and there's murder ballads and people choking each other. But then there's also shaped music from North Carolina. Anyway, it's fascinating. But I was thinking about all that, all those daughters being thrown into all those wells, and that's how that work came about. So this is a work called Field Guides, and. A friend of mine told me that he thought that this looked like like one of the farmers in one of those utopian community pieces I was making earlier. I thought that was kind of weird, but kind of maybe true. And he's sort of, like, a lot of people think that this guy's being anointed or by these butterflies, but I think he's being attacked by them. But that's just me. And I don't want to tell you what to think about my work, but I am, but I'm sorry about that. But... you can do whatever you want and interpret it any way you want. This is a work that I based on photographs I took of my son. He's making his own little messed up utopia out of the outgassing plastic garbage from China that was littering our house at the time. There's little elements of him. He's this sort of Godzilla-like creature, looking over his realm. I had him select all the objects for this work by just going through a toy catalog. And I was like, do you like that thing? He's like, yeah. So he selected everything so that, kind of had a lot to do with his decision making. This is called Expecting to Fly. And it's sort of about the sublime and, crowd surfing, slam dancing, sort of, playing around with Neil Young's song of the same title. This idea of just losing yourself in the great sublime, jumping off the cliff in this sort of Kantian kind of way. This is a work that started out, this is called Airborne Event. This is a work that started out as an abstraction. It was just going to be like chemical kind of, hexagons all linked together. And then I was reading Don DeLillo's White Noise, which talks about an airborne toxic event, and I started thinking about, you know, being captured by the air and thinking about, like, alien space abduction, chemistry in the air killing us, you know, toxic clouds of smog, and then the ascension of the Virgin Mary into heaven. I was raised Catholic, so I have all that in me. And the next thing I knew, this happened. So this is called airborne event. And then at a certain point, you know, the figures haven't completely vanished. There's a work over there's a work in the gallery that's pretty recent where I'm still working with figures. But then for a while, I started making these amalgamations of flowers into birds that were sort of surrogates for figures. It's a work called Hummingbird. There you go. This is a work in the show. Avian flower serpent. Based on a true event, I actually watched a red-tailed hawk swoop down on the ground, pick up a snake, and eat it. And for a minute, it was the map. It was the flag of Mexico. It blew my mind. So I made a painting about it. There's the snake. This is called Avian Fruit Thugs. It's real fig leaves from my garden. This is sort of, a lot of this stuff is like just things that are happening to me now. I guess I could say that like all the sort of like original sort of conceptual ideas that I have in my work are laying at the bottom as a palimpsest of other ideas that are stacking up on top of themselves. It's all still there, but it's much less important to me at this point. And now the things that happen to me on a day-to-day basis are the things that are sort of feeding the work from this point. And also, I'm much more interested in. I became a painter by accident. I'm intuiting my way through this work. I don't really know what it is I'm going to be doing when I go into the studio. I sort of like struggle these objects and images into existence. And then a lot of times, like narrative events that happen in my life end up in my work. This was, I have a fig tree in my backyard, and starlings and mockingbirds are on it every morning eating my figs. I'm always chasing them off. And one day I saw a bird in there. I started chasing it off, and it turned out to be this rare migrant bird for Brooklyn, which is not saying much. But it was a red-breasted grosbeak. I was like, oh, that's so cool. And then this work came out of it. So there you go. This is a work that my son was like, you got all these field guides, but you don't have anything about rocks, and I'm really into money, and so I want to get precious stone thing. So anyway, he helped me make this work called Blue Geode, based on he's kind of like a little cute little Republican. And he's really cutest. This is a work, I did these for a long time where, it's called Phosphine Event, where, you know when you rub your eyes and you get those little patterns that wiggle around afterwards? I would try to draw them really quick before they vanished, just as they were disappearing. That work came out of that. So, this is called Untitled Expulsion, based on Masaccio's expulsion piece. But the reason I made that in 1999. The reason I did that, showed you that, is 2005. I saw this photograph in the front of the New York Times, and I couldn't get it out of my head. I walked around with it all day. I was just looking at it, and I realized that one of the reasons I liked it so much, or what I was so compelled by it. Wait a minute, was that it? Well, what am I doing here? Is that it reminded me of Adam and Eve being expelled from the Garden of Eden, except in this case, Bernie Ebers was being expelled from Wall Street by the camera-wielding paparazzi of the media. And that look, that stunned look on his face, and the clutching of his wife's hands, I couldn't get it out of my head. Like, on one hand, I had nothing but 100% loathing for what he had done and for the people he put out of work and for his own greed and avarice. But on the other hand, I was really compelled by the humanity and the grasping of his wife's hand. So I was really discombobulated by the photograph. And so I began to draw on it, with no intention, no end idea that it would be art. But then I made this thing, and I had been drawing, I'd been graffitiing on the front of the newspaper anyway. you know, after 9/11, I just got so mad about what things were happening. I'd say, fuck you on the paper. And my wife would go, oh, what, wreck my New York Times. And so then Creative Time, this arts organization, asked if I'd make a print, you know. And I said, yeah, I know, I'm going to make blotter acid. Blotter acid, for those of you who don't know, is a paper form of LSD that's perforated, and each little piece of it can be torn off and eaten as a dose. So I found a guy who makes LSD, and I made the print. I sent it to him. He perfed it for me, perforated it, and turned it into a print. But and then that kind of led to a whole bunch of other things. Oh yeah, there's the Masaccio's or my version of Masaccio's expulsion of Adam and Eve. And then it just sort of led to a lot of different things. So I just started doing, I guess when I made the second piece, it became a thing, you know, then it became something. And when New Orleans happened, when Katrina happened in New Orleans, it's a city I dearly love, and I've been there a bunch, so when this came out, front page of New York Times, I guess what I did was I found the waterline of this drowned magical city and then kind of painted this toxic landscape. I painted this sort of toxic waterline abstraction in there. And I guess it just started morphing from there, where I would just, you know, basically what I love about this particular project, it keeps me perpetually off balance. I have to constantly respond to conditions of the photographs as they appear in the context of the news, the surrounding news. So, like in this case, you know, I was thinking about Tom DeLay and Texas's Tom DeLay. And I was thinking about, like, snake handlers and, you know, and I don't know. It wasn't just thinking about snake handlers. It was like the sort of serpentine shapes of this sort of microphones that were in front of his face, and then him, he blew himself, blowing his top, and it just sort of started, each one sort of like just riffing on whatever's happening. And I think these works are really indebted to Warhol's, you know, headline paintings. And I guess, you know, I did a really long talk about Warhol and me at the National Gallery last year, and I won't go into that right now. But he had very different relationship to the news, but it's really uncanny how much his background and my background are the same. Anyway, it's fascinating. But anyway, I just want to give him his props. But the person I feel is most, the person I feel I have the most kinship with this project is probably Miró, specifically the Constellation paintings that he did in the height of World War II, where he was making these sort of cosmic, sort of beautiful, you know, lyrical works in the middle of the most horrific conflict, you know, that the world at that point had ever seen. And there was something intrinsically political about that, about the idea that the world is burning down, but you're still making art. And in a funny way, I sort of feel like my work is coming from the same point. I'm not sure what the politics are in my work. Okay, I'm a liberal and all that stuff, but I don't really believe that these works are going to change the world or anything. I'm not advocating for any particular political ideology, but there's something about the context of like consensus reality around these little drawings that I make, and this idea of my subjective reality imposed upon this alleged consensus or objective reality. The other thing I guess I'm sort of interested in is this idea of this notion of collectivity. You know, the paper is this sort of collectivist entity produced by hundreds, if not thousands, of people that has, for some, you know, where you know, the media has chosen to spotlight particular things and not other things. And as a collagist, I can really relate to that, because I too am working with this sort of a collective of hundreds, and if not thousands, of unnamed authors of that behind all the photographs that I use in my work and all the illustrations that I use in my work. And not only that, the history that I'm working with. So this is something that feels really germane to my ongoing practice as an artist, to acknowledge that. And here I am cannibalizing myself. I took a brochure from the Whitney Museum of my work, cut it up, and because I saw these catenaries with these mullahs with Akhtaminejad, and I thought I would kind of gently humiliate him by putting flowers all over him.